Chapter 18. Let's hear God's word. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Then Paul left the synagogue and went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshipper of God. Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his entire household believed in the Lord, and many of the Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. One night the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. "Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this city." So Paul stayed for a year and a half, teaching them the word of God. "Do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword." Jesus said those words. I guess the mental image many of us have of Jesus is rather incongruous in that connection, isn't it? We think of Jesus as speaking all those words about love. Yet here he is telling his disciples he hasn't come to bring peace, but a sword. Tough words. Harsh and incongruous in the mouth of Jesus, perhaps, and yet they are true words. And words that tonight I want us to think about a little, words we need to think about if we're not going to fall victim to foolish misconceptions about the Christian life. There is a tragic irony about the Master that those of us who are Christians have come here tonight to worship. He came to love the human race, but he was himself despised and rejected. He came to reconcile the human race, but he was himself branded as an outcast. He came to give life to the human race, but he himself was cruelly killed. This, of course, is the paradox of the cross, isn't it? The cross, which the Bible tells us is the instrument of God's peace, is at one and the same time an instrument of human violence. God's kiss of love is at the same time man's swastika of hate. The symbol that wants to extend its arms indefinitely to embrace the world has at its center and its focus a fierce collision of two opposing directions, peace and sword. And Jesus says, "Take up your cross and follow me." In other words, this strange irony of my life will find its echo in yours. "If they called the master of the house a demon," he says, "how much more will they malign his household? If they persecuted me, how much more will they persecute you?" "I'm sending you out," he said to his disciples, "as sheep in the midst of wolves. They will deliver you up to councils. They will flog you in their synagogues. You will be dragged before governors and kings. The time is coming," he said, "when people who kill you think they'll be offering service to God in the process. Do not think then that I have come to bring peace." Not peace, but a sword. Now, as I say, these tough words are words we have to weigh if we're not to have wrong ideas about the Christian life. There is, you see, a cost to being a Christian. I have to admit that at least when you hear the gospel preached by some evangelists, you don't hear much about it. They do their best, perhaps, to keep the advertising positive. But Jesus could never be prosecuted under the Trade Descriptions Act in that way. He was always very upfront about the fact that to be a follower of his involved a cost. For many of us, perhaps, it may be a cost within our family circle. For some, it'll be a cost within our friendships. For some, it may be a cost in terms of our career. And there are plenty of places in the world, even today, where that cost may mean the loss of our freedom or even the loss of your life. Not peace, but a sword. For the hard truth is, the world generally is opposed to Jesus and what he stands for. Oh, there have been times, I know, in history that you can point back to when the church seems to have been politically strong and where Christians seem to have been an advantaged group in society. But those times actually have been pretty rare and pretty localized when you look at it carefully. And even in those times, you will find that people who really took Jesus seriously, who really wanted to follow him in a Bible way, were still a disadvantaged and a disempowered group, even within the institutional church. Not peace, but a sword. Opposition is something, if you're a Christian, you're going to have to get used to the idea of it. And that's particularly true if you have any ambition at all to be an evangelist. Because when you do evangelism, you see, you're on the front line. You're facing the world face to face. Many of the easy places to evangelize in this world today have, generally speaking, been reached. If you look at the mission field, for instance, overseas, where still there are many places where the gospel has yet to reach, generally speaking, the easy places, the responsive groups, they've all been fertilized with indigenous churches that can take responsibility for the evangelism in their areas, within their circle. But the challenge that remains to the church at the end of the 20th century, as far as evangelism and mission is concerned, is the difficult places, the unresponsive places. And those are so often also the places where it's difficult, where the opposition is the toughest. Places which are not just ignorant of the gospel, but ideologically or culturally resistant to it. Like the Muslim world, for instance, or the Hindu world, or the Buddhist world. Or even in this country, the world of inner city alienation and deprivation, where often there's an appalling antagonism to Christianity, just beneath the surface. But these are the places and these are the groups that remain by and large unreached, and are not going to be reached unless people are willing to face the opposition, to make the difficult places their chosen field of Christian work and witness. Even in the university, you see, you can make easy choices or tough choices when it comes to your personal witness. You can choose to stay cosseted in the Kick You group in college. You can have your lunch with your Christian friends. You can go to lectures with your Christian friends. You can spend your leisure hours playing squash or tennis or whatever is your chosen sport with your Christian friends. Or you can reach out into non-Christian groups and non-Christian friends, people who will not share your interest in Jesus and who may even give you a dusty answer if you raise the issue of him with them. Those tough choices remain for all of us, you see. Are we ready to face the opposition for the sake of the gospel? Well, here in Acts 18, we see Paul, this great evangelist and missionary, showing us what it means to live the Christian life and to be an evangelist in a difficult place. And I just want us to observe a couple of things about his methodology in that respect that may be of relevance to you and me. I want us to look, first of all, at how he demonstrates the finding of opportunity in a difficult place. And then I want us to look at the way in which he copes with disappointment in a difficult place. And then I want you to notice how he stays the course in a difficult place. Look first at the way Paul negotiates for himself opportunity in this difficult place of Corinth. Look again at the first three verses. Because he's a tent maker, as Priscilla and Aquila are, he stays and works with them, we're told, as a tent maker. Now, if you think about it, the first thing anybody who's going to be a Christian in a new situation has to do is to find some kind of identity for themselves, which gives them acceptance and opportunity in the society they would like to be a witness to for Jesus' sake. Now at Athens, if you were here last week, you'll remember we studied Paul's ministry there in that city. It had been relatively easy for a fellow like Paul to find an identity for himself that gave him acceptance. He presented himself in Athens as a visiting lecturer at the university. Such things were done in Athens. It was that kind of place. The Forum, as we said last week, was not so much a marketplace as an intellectual gymnasium where you went to exercise your wits on the latest philosophical theories. Paul's academic training made it very easy, and I guess very congenial for him, to slot in there, to exploit that opportunity which the university atmosphere of Athens presented for the gospel. But Corinth was a very different place, and therefore a very different approach was needed. It was only 50 miles away from Athens, but the atmosphere there was as unlike Athens as Cambridge, or rather London, is different from Cambridge. If Cambridge is the Athens of this part of the world, London is the Corinth. Corinth was a huge commercial centre. If you go there even today and look at the ruins, you can see all the little ranks of shops that surrounded the city centre. And the harbour there, vast quantities of goods passed en route across the Peloponnesian Peninsula in Corinth. It was a very wealthy place, a place with the bustle of trade, not a philosophical debate. Well, I want you to notice the flexibility that Paul demonstrates in that new situation. See? In academic Athens, he had presented himself as a university lecturer. What does he do in commercial Corinth? He becomes a businessman. He becomes a tent maker and works with them. Now, it would be a mistake, I think, to jump to the conclusion that Paul's tent making was simply a financial necessity. There may have been some financial stake involved, but he tells us in his letter to the Corinthians later on that this was in fact a conscious evangelistic policy on his part. He saw that in the Corinthian situation, to support himself by his own labor offered less hindrance to the gospel than to present himself as a professional preacher or lecturer. He gives a couple of reasons for that in his Corinthian letter. He says, first of all, he wanted to make the gospel free of charge. The point being that there were an awful lot of traveling preachers in the Greek world, not Christian preachers necessarily at all, but people who made their living out of people's religious aspirations. Paul didn't want to be put in the same pigeonhole with those charlatans. But if he'd relied upon collections taken from new converts or would-be converts to keep himself in food and clothing and accommodation, then that would have been the kind of image he'd have been presenting. So he did it to make the gospel free of charge, he says. And the other reason, he says, that he adopted the kind of evangelistic policy he did at Corinth was because he wanted to identify with the people there. He says it was his general policy to become all things to all men so that by all possible means he might save some. Paul always looked around for some way to belong to the group of people he was trying to reach with the gospel, to have something in common with them. Now that, I say, is a flexibility that all of us who are Christians who want our lives to count for Jesus have got to try to develop. If you're a new student here in the university, you've got a great opportunity with all these societies and what have you that are anxious to get your name on their list, to find an identity for yourself that will give you access and acceptance within non-Christian circles in the university. Oh, please join the Christian Union too and make sure they've got your name. But there are other ways, you see. You can identify with Cambridge and its university setting that will give you an entree, just like Paul does here. And if you were a missionary overseas, or an evangelist in some of the difficult parts of this country, it will be even more important for you to think imaginatively about how can I find the right kind of hole to locate myself in for the sake of my effectiveness as a Christian in the world. When I lived in Africa many years ago, I remember talking to mission directors. And one of the complaints they sometimes voiced to me was that these days, when people become missionaries and go out on the mission field, they always go out as experts in something or other. You know, they've all got qualifications, piles of pieces of paper, which they've spent years collecting. And they really feel rather cheated if God doesn't give them an opportunity on the mission field, which exploits all these bits of paper that they've spent so much time collecting. But you see, when you get out there in the real world, very often the bits of paper you've got don't count very much. They aren't terribly relevant. The best opportunities may be in a completely different area altogether. And what those mission directors really longed for was somebody with the sacrificial flexibility to adapt radically to the opportunity that presented itself instead of demanding a whole that was precisely shaped the way they were already. That was the way Paul thought, you see. I've no doubt he had learned tent making as a young rabbi. I'm sure he never thought he'd use it again once he became a respected scholar. But when he goes to Corinth, you see, you don't find him writing indignant letters back to his mission board at Antioch, complaining that he's in totally the wrong place, and requesting that they urgently send out a shopkeeper instead of a trained theologian like him. Huh? No, he adapts. He's a bit like a chameleon. He looks for a hole and shapes himself to it. He doesn't look for a Paul-shaped hole. If there's no Paul-shaped hole there, he'll look for a good hole and then make Paul fit it. So he says in another place in that Corinthian correspondence, to the Jew I became a Jew, to the Greek I became a Greek. He might have gone on to say, at the faculty at Athens I became a lecturer, and to the business community in Corinth I became a tent maker. God needs tent makers, and nowhere more does he need them than in the difficult places. Because in those difficult places, you see, the professional Christian, the official Christian, the person like me, for instance, they are really handicapped. Sometimes you can't even get into a country with minister of religion on your passport, you know. Many hostile cultures do not want Christian evangelists. They shut the door on them. And anybody who doesn't make an economic contribution to the development of the country is viewed with suspicion as some kind of parasite or possibly some kind of CIA suspect. There's a challenge there in Paul's example to us, you see. To abandon our stereotyped ideas of what a missionary looks like and learn from his example of flexibility. Whether we're professional missionaries, whether we're unofficial missionaries, whether we're just Christians trying to live lives of open testimony in the university or in the city here, we need this kind of opportunism, this kind of enterprise, this kind of flexibility. Finding an opportunity for ourselves. There's a sentence too, isn't there, in verse 1, in this connection, which may be of particular interest to the students here. Do you notice that phrase, Paul left Athens? Now, by temperament and training, I'm sure Paul felt some reluctance to leave Athens. I would have done, wouldn't you? Best place for him, I would have thought. He could have, humanly speaking, have stayed in those corridors of learning for years, sharpening his mind against the Stoics and the Epicureans. And I very little doubt he would have quickly established his reputation as a scholar there. In fact, looked at one way, you might have said Athens was the obvious place for a man of his gifts. But I want you to notice it wasn't to be. Paul left Athens. Isn't that significant? Because part of this flexibility we're talking about means being willing to sacrifice our preferences. It may even be about forfeiting some of our potential. Now maybe you've got a good mind. Well, imagine to get to this place, you must have a pretty good mind. You'll get a degree. Maybe you'll get a good degree. Maybe you're capable of going on to do research and get even more letters after your name. One day maybe there'll be folk who are sitting here who one day will be sitting on professors' chairs. Well, that may be so. That may be your potential. But it doesn't necessarily follow that it's God's will that you should stay in that academic environment and fulfill that potential. It may be so. We need Christians in the academic world. But not necessarily. You know, one of the greatest missionary heroes of Cambridge, of course, is the young man called Henry Martin, that they've named Henry Martin Hall after in next to Holy Trinity. He was top scholar of his year, and he went out to be a missionary in Asia and died at the age of only 31. I suppose some people might regard that as a waste of a great scholar. And actually, when you look at history, God has regularly fed the missionary endeavor of the church around the world from academies of learning like Cambridge University. Because it isn't academic flops he needs or chooses. It is the Pauls of this world. The work of evangelism is tough and intellectually demanding and requires the best people we have. That front line is not a comfortable place to be. So you see, he might call you. I have to tell you, it's a possibility. Educated though you are, he might call you to leave the comfortable life you could so easily negotiate for yourself as a Cambridge graduate and go instead to a difficult place. Maybe in this country, maybe overseas. He may ask you to make that tough choice. He may ask you to hang up your academic gown and abandon the quietness of the library and the cool reasonableness of the common room so that you can be a preacher in the marketplace. As Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. For, you see, I have to tell you this, heaven is not going to be full of academics. The Bible says so quite specifically. When Paul wrote back to Corinth, he said, just look at your calling, brethren. Not many who are wise, according to this world's standards, have been called by God. Rather, God has chosen the foolish in the world. And if you look around the Church of Jesus Christ, you have to say that Paul's observation is right. But how gracious of God to choose the foolish in the world. And what a relief it may be to some of us to know that heaven is not going to be full of the esoteric dissertations of university professors. But for that reason, for that very reason, you see, it is necessary for some of us to leave Athens. Incarcerated in that academic ivory tower environment, we will not really be at the forefront of mission. The cutting edge of mission is in Corinth. So it mustn't surprise us when God takes good academics out of the academic environment and puts them somewhere tough, where you would have thought their degrees were rather less valuable. Flexibility, then, that's the first thing I want you to notice. The way Paul finds an opportunity for himself in Corinth to be a missionary, to be an evangelist, even if it means giving up ideas about his own role and career, which he might have had. The next thing I want you to notice, just as important, is the way he copes with disappointment there. The way he copes with disappointment. Look at verses 4 to 6. Every Sabbath he reasons in the synagogue and tries to persuade the Jews and the Greeks who gather there. And when Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia, perhaps with additional funds, he judges that he can now devote himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus is their Messiah, the Christ. But then you see, the opposition begins to raise its head. The Jews oppose Paul and become abusive. What does he do? He shakes out his clothes in protest and says to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." There are two major barriers to the success of the gospel in any human individual's heart. One barrier we came across last week, actually, in Athens. The barrier of cross-cultural misunderstanding. Do you remember the philosophers in Athens last week who thought that Paul was preaching foreign gods, gods plural? And we said to her, how on earth did they get the idea that a monotheist like Paul, a Jew, could believe in more than one god? And we suggested the reason was that, as Luke tells us, it was because Paul was preaching Jesus and the resurrection, which to Greek ears, untutored Greek ears who didn't know much about the Jewish faith or the Christian faith, sounded like the names of two gods, Jesus and his female consort, Anastasia, the resurrection. So it was a classic example, you see, of how important it is when you're trying to explain the Christian message to people to recognize that all communication is a bilateral event. That what we think we're saying and what our audience are actually hearing may be two completely different things. The reason for that is, as we said last week, that people have a shape in their minds. And whenever we receive new information, we try to fit that new information onto that established pattern in our minds. Only with great difficulty does anybody accept the need to adopt a different pattern, a new paradigm, a new worldview. Still, that obstacle of cross-cultural misunderstanding can be overcome if we're patient, if we, as Paul did, go back to fundamental things, if we look, as Paul did, for a point of contact, some issue that gives us a way in to being able to dialogue with people meaningfully, it is possible to negotiate these communication hang-ups. Unfortunately, there is a second barrier, though, to the reception of the Christian message, which may hinder the gospel no matter how successful you are in making yourself understood. And that's the barrier we're encountering here in Corinth. Think about these Jews. Now, were they victim to some kind of cross-cultural hang-up? I don't think so. No one was in a better position than they were to understand the message Paul was bringing. They had a Bible. They worshipped the God of the Bible. They were waiting for the Messiah promised in the Bible. But when Rabbi Paul entered their synagogue and announced that the Messiah for whom they were waiting was Jesus, they very quickly began to oppose and revile him. Persistently, we're told, he reasons with them. Sabbath after Sabbath, he turns up there and patiently explains it over and over again to them, answering their questions, rebutting their objections. When these friends of his come, he gives himself up completely to this task. But still, they remain adamant. This is not incomprehension, I suggest to you. This is just rank disbelief. And such unbelief is a far more intractable obstacle to the gospel than just misunderstanding. Because it's not a function of the mind, you see, it's a function of the heart and the will. These people did not want Jesus to be their Christ. They knew perfectly well what Paul was saying. They didn't want it to be true. And that, I'm afraid to say, is always the ultimate barrier. Jesus himself, at least I think it's Jesus in John's Gospel, comments that the light comes into the world, but the tragedy is so often that people prefer the darkness. What do you do? How do you tackle that kind of defiant rejection when you face that sort of disappointment? We've all had it, haven't we? Maybe some of you have had it in your family. You tried so hard to explain why you're a Christian to your parents or some brother or sister. You really wish they would share your faith. But they're adamant that they don't want to, and they even get irritated with you and make life hard for you, perhaps. Maybe with your friends. You've got friends that you care about so much, and you've been talking to them about Jesus for years. But they never seem to change. Maybe you even come from a cultural situation which is hostile to the gospel. You know that back home, where you live, if you were to get baptized in public, it would cause endless trouble for you and for your family. What do you do with that kind of disappointment, that kind of opposition? How do you handle it? Well, there are two things I want you to notice about the way Paul handles it here. The first is, I want you to notice the way in which Paul refuses to compromise his message. Verse 6. When they become abusive, he shakes out his clothes in protest and says, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility." See, when we're faced with people who are hostile to our Christian testimony, it is very easy, in our desperate desire to make them change their attitude toward us, it's terribly easy to compromise the message, to change it into something that they'll find more acceptable. Technically, on the mission field, that's called syncretism. Mixing the Christian message up with the ideas that are already current in the culture to make a mix which people find easier to believe. And a man of Paul's intellect could easily have employed this as a strategy in Corinth. He had the theological genius to construct a Christianized Judaism that would have won that whole synagogue. Oh, he could easily have done it. In fact, Paul could have devised a Christianized Hellenism for the Greeks and a Christianized imperialism for the Romans and a Christianized paganism for the world in general. That when you look around the world and at the history of mission, you have to say plenty of so-called theology today is characterized by such a strategy of tactical surrender. For we live, don't we, in a day when people are embarrassed by dogmatism. Everybody's entitled to their own point of view. The only unforgivable sin is intolerance. I heard somebody say it only last Sunday. Oh, I'm so terrified of appearing intolerant. Well, aren't we all these days? It's so politically incorrect. So let the Muslim worship God his way, let the Hindu get to heaven his way. There's one very prominent theologian in the Roman Catholic Church who tells us that we should regard all unbelievers as anonymous Christians. They're really all Christians already, they just don't realize it, he said. That's the way to think of them. There's another very prominent Protestant theologian who has urged that all our missionary societies should dismantle themselves, and we should stop talking about different religions of the world competing for converts, for proselytes. Rather, he urges, all the great world faiths should combine together to offer the world one common mission toward the goal of some kind of generalized, amorphous spirituality. And you perhaps have already observed that even in quite sound Christian circles, the word proclamation, which is a Bible word for preaching the gospel, is regarded with great suspicion in lots of quarters. People prefer the word dialogue. Sounds humbler somehow, less self-assured. Well, I simply want you to observe Paul's attitude in this situation. They did not like his message, but he does not change it to suit their ears. He will not compromise it. Why not? Because though he was a chameleon himself and would radically adapt to the culture in his own person, he would not camouflage the gospel message. It was a non-negotiable message as far as he was concerned. He didn't see himself, you see, as a philosopher offering some new idea for discussion or as a mere rabbi with some new biblical interpretation to suggest. No, he was an apostle. That's the word he uses of himself. And an apostle in the New Testament was somebody who had received direct from Jesus the authority to explain the gospel. An apostle was somebody who had seen Jesus risen from the dead with their own eyes. That being so, you see, Paul feels an immense dignity in his office as an apostle. This is no fit of pique that makes him say, "Your blood be upon your heads." This isn't Paul being peevish. This is the solemn consequence of what the gospel message which he was commissioned to preach claims to be. You can reject the ideas of men with impunity, they're only opinions. But people have to know that if they reject this Christian gospel, this word of God, they are staking their life on that decision to do so. "Your blood be upon your own heads," he says. "If you're wrong about this, you're putting your very soul in jeopardy," he says. And that's why, you see, an evangelist, a Christian who is really going to be true to the Bible, has not only to invite people in the warmest terms to find Jesus and eternal life in him, in good conscience they must also warn people of hell, of the consequences of rejecting him. We can remove every possible barrier of misunderstanding and cultural alienation that may contribute to the hostility of the people we're trying to reach. We can contextualize our theological language so we're using words they understand. We can translate the Bible so that the Bible itself is in words that they understand. We can identify ourselves personally in every possible way with our hearers so that they don't fail to hear the message because of anything about us or the way we speak. But the message itself, I say again, it's non-negotiable. We daren't try to change that, no matter what the pressure may be. We can only say to people, if they insist on refusing it after all our efforts, "If you are lost, you must take the blame for it yourself." It's the first thing I want you to notice about the way Paul responds to this opposition, to this disappointment. He refuses to compromise the message, though he must have been sorely tempted to do so. But the second thing I want you to notice in this connection is this. I want you to notice the dignity which Paul bestows on his hearers, even in their unbelief. At least that's the way I interpret what he did. From now on, he says, I go to the Gentiles. See, if our testimony has been rejected by the people we want so much to receive the gospel and to receive Jesus, if we overcome the temptation to compromise our message in that rejected situation, there is a further danger. We might be tempted to try to compromise our methods. We might try, you see, to bypass this hardened attitude we're encountering by being manipulative or underhanded in some way. I mean, you're not unfamiliar with this sort of stuff. One way it's often done, if we're honest, in Christian circles is emotionalism, for instance. If we can't get people to profess faith through a rational commitment of the will, as a result of us presenting the gospel to them and reasoning with them and them understanding and embracing it for themselves. If we can't get a profession of faith through a rational commitment of the will, then you can always try for a response that derives totally from the feelings. You can whip people up into some kind of emotional state and say, wow, you've been converted. Or another way is to offer psychological bribes. You can find some felt need and assure them that Jesus will meet it. You can promise children to the barren, examination passes to the student, jobs to the unemployed, rice to the hungry, healing to the sick, residence visas to the refugees. In fact, if Paul had been with us today, you know, he might have been tempted to use some of our new, sophisticated, modern techniques of human manipulation. The things that have been discovered by the hidden persuaders of our world, you know, subliminal advertising, behavioral conditioning, brainwashing. I mean, what's wrong with it? People have been converted from Pepsi-Cola to Coca-Cola with such means. People have been converted from being dissidents to being good communists by such means. Why not convert people from unbelief to Christian faith by such means? I mean, we'd only be doing it for their good, wouldn't we? We know we're right. Well, suffice it to say, Paul not only refuses to compromise his message, he will not compromise his methods either. We read, he argued. He tried to convince through reasoned argument. It is immensely important that you note that. He does so with passion and with perseverance. But when, in spite of all his efforts, resistance mounts to crisis point, he does not look around for some new technique of persuasion. He says instead, I'm clear of my responsibility and I'm going to take this message to somebody else. There came a point, in other words, when Paul accepted a negative response. That's what I mean when I say he invested dignity in his hearers, even in their unbelief. See, self-determination is part of human dignity. God has made us human beings creatures who know freedom and responsibility. And respect for that human dignity requires that Christians can never join the ranks of those officious dictators of mass opinion who seek to control the world by psychological manipulations of one kind or another. Those methods simply aren't open to us. We have more respect for human beings than that. That's why we find Paul again writing to the Corinthians in his letter later on. We have renounced, he says, disgraceful, underhanded methods. We refuse, he says, to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. Rather, he says, by open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to everybody's conscience in the sight of God. That was his strategy. And he says, if people's eyes are shut to our gospel, then at the end of the day, we accept that they are lost. It is possible, you see, to be evangelized and yet unconverted. We have to recognize that. It's tough recognizing it. It's tough recognizing it in a member of your family that you love or a friend that you have cared so much for. It's tough recognizing it about the culture that you come from, that a whole group of people have collectively turned their back on this gospel. But that is sometimes what happens, you see. And we can't offer bribes or exploit emotions or use dehumanizing techniques to avoid that conclusion that they have said no, they don't want it. Christians are committed to only those strategies of persuasion that are consistent with our biblical understanding of human dignity. And the awful consequence of that commitment is that sometimes we, as indeed God does, sometimes we have to allow people to damn themselves, to make a choice that we know, from the bottom of our hearts, we know is lethal. I know hell is a dreadful idea. I don't find it easy to talk about it, I promise you. But I will tell you this. Hell gives more dignity to a human being than a brainwasher ever does. For hell respects the sinner's choice. Hell accepts the sinner's refusal. Hell treats a human being as a responsible creature. Your blood is on your own head, it says. Our 20th century brainwasher doesn't give human beings the dignity of being punished for their crimes. It seeks instead to reprogram them as if they were lumps of malleable clay to be molded at will by those who, quote, know what's best for them. Well, hell may be a dreadful thought, but those who suffer there are still human. They are not robots. God may be a sovereign, but he has never tyrannized a human soul. They wanted independence of him. They have got it. We too have to give people that dignity. In the difficult place, when you're faced with cruel disappointment, you sometimes have to be willing to give people that dignity of accepting their refusal. Even as Jesus did. Do you remember, perhaps you don't, as he was coming to Jerusalem in the last week of his life, he saw the city of Jerusalem spread out before him from a hill, and he cried over it. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets, stoning those who are sent to you, how often I would have gathered you together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. He wept over the city. And I suspect Paul wept over Corinth too. You must not think that these words, your blood be upon your own head, were spoken with an anti-Semitic snarl and a curled lip. Remember who Paul is? He's a Jew. He's a rabbi. These are his people. If you know anything of the heart of this man, you will know what tears he shed for his own people, the Jewish people, because they had said no to Jesus. And this is the agony, of course, of the cross, reproduced in the experience of the evangelist. We so much want people to find what we have found. And maybe they are even our own kin or our own friends. So bonds of human affection are tied up with it all for us. But they have rejected him. And because Jesus respected their human dignity, he accepted that rejection. That hurts. That's what put him on the cross. The acceptance of his own people's rejection. Still, he loved them. So must we. But there is no way around that Calvary for those who want to be witnesses in the difficult places. Finally, time slipping away, there's one more thing I want you to notice. And it may be for some of us the most important thing of all. I want you to notice how Paul kept on going, how he stayed the course in this difficult place. Look at verses 7 to 9 again. Paul leaves the synagogue, goes next door to the house of Titius Justus. Many believe, and that night, or one night, the Lord speaks to Paul in a vision. Do not be afraid, he says. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you because I have many people in this city. So Paul stayed. Notice that. Paul stayed there for a year and a half. Now, it would have been very easy for Paul, I think, to slink out of Corinth at verse 6. I'd have been sorely tempted to take this as divine guidance that I wasn't intended to stay in this city anymore, wouldn't you? Slink out like a dog with his tail between his legs, perhaps. He'd been humiliated, he'd been insulted, he had been hurt emotionally, and he was getting very close to being physically beaten up. He was afraid. That's why, of course, it says in verse 9, do not be afraid. God didn't say that because, but for no purpose. He knew that staying in the city further was a risk to his physical safety. He knew what the Jews could do to those they took to be heretics. He had seen Stephen martyred. He had seen James, the brother of John, executed. He himself had been assaulted more than once. I imagine the scars of that flogging he had in Philippi were still visible on his body. He wrote to Corinth again much later, I was with you, he says, in weakness and in much fear and trembling. And I think he's talking about physical cowardice there. He was really afraid. But then, of course, the encouraging thing about feeling like that is that unless you're really afraid, you can't be courageous, can you? I mean, you know, the idiot who faces battle with no trepidation at all in his heart isn't brave, is he? He's a fool. The person of courage is a person who, yes, is afraid, but stands their ground in spite of their fear. So if you're feeling anxious and fearful coming up to Cambridge as a Christian, feeling stripped of all those supports that you once had around your life, feeling very isolated, not take courage. For courage is one of the things you can discover you've got in this situation, and maybe you haven't had much opportunity to do that yet. If Paul, you see, had left Corinth at verse 6, as I'm sure he was tempted to do, he would have never known, would he, what a phenomenal harvest he had missed. He needed to find that courage, the guts to stick it out in that hostile, difficult environment. And I want you to notice that the way he found that courage, there are a number of things associated with it. But clearly, this vision in the nighttime in verse 9 was key, wasn't it? Do not be afraid, God says to Paul. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you. That's great, isn't it? He surrounds Paul's fragile ego with his great supernatural divine ego. I am with you. No one's going to attack and harm you because I have many people in this city. That's a present tense in the Greek. Literally, a great number are mine. Think about it, that's a rather astonishing thought. God is saying that people belong to him before they realize they do. A great number of people are mine in this city. Now, you see, evangelism often feels to us like a very chancy business. It doesn't feel chancy as far as God's concerned. To us, maybe a situation looks bleak with discouragement and difficulty. But the fact is, the results of Christian mission are never in doubt as far as God's concerned. Why? Because his people belong to him. They belong to him even before they realize they belong to him. Paul would even go so far later on in his writings to say that God's people belong to him from the foundation of the world. For that's how mighty God's intelligence is. The evangelist, you see, doesn't create the people of God. He simply discovers who they are. I've sometimes, you know, met people who give you the idea from the way they talk that Jesus must have retired to heaven after he died on the cross, wringing his hands in nervous anxiety in case nobody believed in him. And it was all a complete waste of time and effort. They portray the whole plan of salvation as some monstrous gamble on God's part. I can't think of anything more ridiculous. It's certainly not biblical. Jesus says with great confidence and calmness, I know my sheep. I'm laying down my life for them. And there are other sheep. I know about them too, and I will bring them. God knows who his people are, you see. Maybe you're a non-Christian here tonight. This could be a rather searching observation, couldn't it? I mean, haven't you noticed? Come on, be honest. Though you're a non-Christian, haven't you noticed that there's a sort of nagging at the back of your mind about this Christianity thing? Isn't that perhaps why you're here? Because deep down inside, there's a little voice in you that's saying, in spite of all your objections and your doubts, there's something in this. There's something in this, something I need, something important. Where does that little voice come from? Parental conditioning? Memories of early Sunday school experiences coming back to haunt you? Or could it be that God has already begun to work inside you? Supposing, though, you're not a non-Christian, suppose you're already a Christian. This is a word, isn't it, that has a lot of relevance to you in your evangelism. I've sometimes heard it said, you know, this idea that God has people and knows who his people are before they actually become conscious that they belong to God. I've sometimes heard it suggested that this saps motivation in evangelism. You know, it's like, if God knows who's going to be saved, what's the bother of, why bother with preaching? You know, it's all a waste of time, isn't it? But that, of course, isn't borne out by experience, you know. But what we see here in the experience of Paul, you could multiply 1,000 times in the experience of great evangelists and missionaries the world over. When it's difficult, when you're facing opposition, it is only the knowledge that God has people he intends to save that nerves your will to go on preaching in spite of apparent disappointment. Paul's given his all, you see, in Corinth, and he's been rejected. If the conversion of men and women depends on Paul's ability to persuade people, he's already a monumental failure. But our ability is actually a minor factor in God's strategy, you see, because we are merely in the business of sowing and watering. It is always God at the end of the day who generates new life, who opens blind eyes. God knows his people even before the foundation of the world. Jim Packer says in one of his books, the fact that God knows people before the foundation of the world doesn't make evangelism unnecessary, it's the thing that makes it effective. That's the thing I'd like you to hang on to. Maybe you look around your college, you look around your friends in the department, and you think to yourself, gosh, this is going to be tough. None of these people could ever become Christians. They're so self-confident. They're so inured in their non-Christian lifestyle. What do they need the gospel for? And how are they going to look at me and think I've got anything worth having? Most of them are more confident socially than I am, more together psychologically than I am. I'm a mess in comparison with most of them. In terms of witness, I'm already a failure. No, it's pointless. What's the use of me trying to be a witness to them? Maybe that's the way you feel. I've often felt like that. Well, be reassured. Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent. I am with you. No one's going to attack and harm you. I have many people in this city. When God looks around Cambridge, when he looks around the university, even around the new first year intake, he says, I have many people in this city. They belong to me already. I'm already working on them. I'm calling them. I'm drawing them. That little voice inside them is already having its effect, even though they may be trying to deny it and not showing a flicker externally about it. But they are mine. I know who they are. And if you are a faithful testifier to Jesus, you will discover who they are too. And what a joy that will be to you, to be a co-worker with God in bringing those people to Jesus. That's the logic that kept Paul in Corinth then. Do you notice where he located the church? Right next door to the synagogue. Really quite impertinent, wasn't it? But that was the confidence this man seems to have found in the situation. Confidence to pitch his tent right at the doorstep of the opposition. And that is the audacity we need too, you see. C.T. Studd, I've quoted this so often, but a great Cambridge cricketer of an earlier generation, C.T. Studd, went out as a missionary to China. He wrote a little couplet that I dearly love. It goes like this. Some want to live within the sound of church or chapel bell. I want, he says, to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell. That's an ambition to aspire for. To be on the front line. To be a witness where it counts. To be a witness that gives the devil something to worry about. Oh, it will be difficult, and you will face opposition. There are safer places to be, but nowhere more important. Let's pray together.